Francis Rochefort, I'm the author of Defense of Condo and Homeowner Rights and publisher of the first Homeowner's Defense Kit. Please visit my website at starpublications.com. That's star with two R's, publications with an S.com. The Homeowner's Defense Kit trilogy, which includes my book, is the first link on the left. I also offer telephone consultations on condo boards, HOA boards, and homeowner rights problems, and also books on other topics. Our topic today is Homeland Security Begins at Home, how to stop cyber threats and identity theft attacks on your home and your office. Our guest is Dr. David Gilbert of ZATZ.com, that's Z-A-T-Z.com. He's a prolific author, the Cyber Terrorism Advisor for the International Association for Counterterrorism and Security Professionals, and a columnist for the Journal of Counterterrorism and Homeland Security International. Welcome, David.
Hey, Joyce, how are you?
I'm terrific and so happy to have you on the show, especially the day following the election. I'm sure you're going to have many interesting insights about challenges facing the new administration.
Absolutely. In fact, what I'd like to do, if you don't mind, is I'd like to do a short public service announcement to everybody who's listening. There is a piece of email going around right now that basically says Obama wouldn't be first black president as the subject message. If you open the message, it will suggest that you download the new Flash Player. Please do not open the message or download the new Flash Player. What it's doing is it's capturing people's email addresses, and it's sending them off to the Ukraine. And it's also going and installing something called a rootkit into your computer, which will monitor everything typed on your computer and send that off to the Ukraine, obviously for identity theft. And this is a zero-day alert, which means it's happening right now.
Can you repeat again what the subject line is?
Yes. It basically says the subject that this particular one is says Obama wouldn't be first black president. And it comes from something called the Election Results Center. Now, the thing is, anybody who asks you to install a copy of anything on your computer should be ignored. But in particular, this one is suggesting that you install a copy of Adobe Flash 9. And as you do, basically what you're doing is you're running a program on your computer that allows another program to sort of sneak behind your computer and hide there, watching everything you do. And what it's doing, what that rootkit is doing, that program is sending messages of your activity and contents of your computer to a series of computers that are in the Ukraine at the moment, and they're capturing all sorts of nasty stuff. So this is today's hot warning about where Homeland Security begins at home. Definitely do not.
Do you have any idea how many people have already been affected?
Well, we're sure that millions of these things have been sent out. We don't know how many people have opened them, but usually in a situation like this, far too many people open them up. And I'll go into more general warnings about practices that your listeners can do to make sure they protect themselves from this style of attack. But this one is active as of today, and it's today's new and happy little event.
I'm very happy that you warned our listeners about this. Why don't we start with the overview of cyber war and cyber terrorism? People feel that it's so distant from their lives, unless, of course, they're attacked with identity theft, but they can't quite, put identity theft together with cyber war. It's a little bit far-fetched. So would you explain it all?
Sure. Cyber war is pretty easy to define. It's any time you are attacked or a nation is attacked using computer technology. So it's a very, very broad term. An attack could take on very broad definitions. It can be anything from information stolen from you, as is the case with this particular rootkit that I just mentioned, to systems intending to compromise other systems, to information being stolen for various strategic purposes and so forth. We have a lot of this going on now. It is, I describe cyber war as much more like a cancer than like a bullet to the chest. It's something that infects you and is around for a long time and is difficult to get rid of. And that's what, many of us are dealing with right now. And it affects nations like America it affects companies and offices like Homeland Security, but it affects individuals as well, because the people like you and me and our parents and our bosses and the kid down the street are all potential carriers of these attacks. Basically, we're the folks who may let the attacks in to cause these sorts of damage. And so while the one that's nearest and dearest to most of our hearts is making sure our wallets are protected, this same technology can be used for all sorts of nasty activities. I'll give you one example. There's something called phishing, which is basically spoofing the way somebody would access a computer and making it look like you're going to a regular website. And in today's Newsweek, for example, there's an announcement that the FBI has approached both the Obama and McCain campaigns because apparently both of their networks were compromised in an attempt to steal policy documents off of their computers, so that were the either of those two people elected, there'd be some idea of what their policies were for potential future negotiations. This is something that's happened relatively recently. Both campaigns were affected. The FBI was clear to say that it was not a case of one campaign attacking the other, but instead actually has been traced to potentially either China or Russia. So, you know, we're talking about some pretty serious stuff. For you and me, what it means is things like credit cards being compromised and bills that we, you know, owe for things we didn't purchase and all sorts of other stuff like that that can take, you know, hundreds and hundreds of hours to clean up if it happens to us.
What is the result of something like this on the nation? All right, the Chinese, somebody in China, somebody in Russia may have been at the highest level, may not. They get their hands on policy documents. What can they actually do with those?
Well, I mean, for example, although we know, we and let's just say our enemies know a reasonable amount about the policies of both Barack Obama and John McCain, you know, any organization, whether it's a president or a company, internally has plans for how would we approach this situation, or, you know, what is our negotiating stance for that organization, or, you know, if there's a situation coming along and this is as far as we'll go but no further, to make sure that their representatives know how to communicate this stuff. If our policies are known to our enemies, they can push their advantage. I mean, think about it in a simple case. Like, you're in a negotiation to, let's say, buy a piece of jewelry at a store. And you know you're willing to pay up to $100 because you really like the thing. But you're trying to negotiate them down. If they know that you want it real bad, they might even push that price up to $110 because you're probably going to go for it. But if they don't know you want it really bad, you might get away with buying the thing for $30 or $40. That kind of thing, writ large, is the sort of thing that can happen if our negotiating stances are available to people who we don't want to know our strategy.
It amazes me how careless people are. I've been telling almost everybody I email, please do not send me forwarded email and do not forward my emails to other parties. Almost everybody ignores my request and will so often send me the cutest little note that they received from their friends or something about the campaign. I don't want it. I didn't ask you for it. Please don't do it. And they keep doing it. How do we educate people to stop it?
Well, we actually wrote, I wrote an article a year or so ago about that particular issue, that when it comes to email forwarding, sharing is not caring. And in fact, if your listeners want to read that, just go to outlookpower.com. That's www.outlookpower.com and do a search for sharing and caring in the search box, and it'll come up. But the thing is that you're dealing with a social issue in this case, as opposed to a technical issue. Although I've sometimes solved it technically. I've told people that if you keep sending me this stuff, I'm just going to block your email address and you'll never get through to me. Now, I get somewhere above 10,000 email messages a day, so I have to protect the cycle of the amount of messages I get simply to be able to survive through this. And those people who really want to get replies back from me after a while learn the lesson, because I will shut them off if they keep up the practice.
Do you get 10,000 emails a day?
I have had an email address on the internet since before there was an internet. I reach more than a million people a week, and unfortunately, both in terms of junk email and in terms of people who want us to write about them or want my attention on something or want to send me a press release, I get a god-awful amount of email.
Do you post an email address on the internet?
My email address has been posted on the internet. My email address has been posted on what is the internet itself since like 94, and versions of my various email addresses, including going all the way back to way before there was an internet, are available online in various archives going back to like 1978.
Do you change those email addresses, or you don't worry about having them up there?
It's one of those things where at this point it just doesn't matter. It's been there for so long, and people know how to get a hold of me. Now, the good thing is that people can get a hold of me, but I do run my email through five separate filtering mechanisms so that the message, for example, the message that you sent me got through because you were somebody I know and somebody I've approved of and so forth. But it does go through. It goes through a wide variety of spam filtering, both at the ISP and at our own servers and then through to my computer as a way to filter out the bulk of that junk. When filtering is done, I get about 500 to 1,000 messages a day I actually have to look at.
Well, now, of course, most of us depend on Google or whatever email service we use to do that filtering to protect us. But from what you're saying now, that's not enough.
No. That's why for folks who are very visible, I use something called Postini at the very top end of the thing. Postini.
What's it called?
It's called Postini, PostiniI.com. It's actually owned by Google. And what happens is it is a service that every message passes through, and it does a first layer filtering. Basically, think of it as a sieve. It blocks everything that is very obviously junk mail. Then my messages go through a server that my corporation operates that does another filter through something called Spam Assassin that pulls out the next layer of those messages. It also pulls out messages containing potentially damaging attachments and things like that. That then goes on to something called an exchange server, which does its round of filtering, and then that comes down to my Outlook, which has two rounds of filtering, one which is called Spam Bays and one which is Outlook's own native junk filter. And when all that is done, I have way too much mail I need to read anyway, but it's a lot less than the 10,000 that starts at the very beginning of that cycle every day.
Well, at least you're less threatened, let us say.
Yeah, exactly.
But here we are, the average person, the average Joe, or Jill, as we might say, really doesn't know how to protect themselves other than relying on AOL or Gmail or any other account. I think anybody who uses Outlook and receives their email inside their computer is a bit nuts, but that's just my personal point of view. I stopped that years ago. I don't remember the last time I did so. Would you agree with that?
No. And you got to understand that I don't agree with that for a couple reasons, one of which is I'm the editor of Outlook Power Magazine.
To
a certain extent, I'm not going to be able to agree with that. But
right.
The reality is that different kinds of email clients serve different people. Outlook is a client that runs on your computer. It's a piece of software that runs on your computer,
mm-hmm.
as opposed to Gmail, which is something that's run by Google.
Correct.
Those people in a corporate world will often want to control their own email, and they'll want to control their own servers and not rely on either the identity provided by Gmail, like your email address is an @gmail.com address, or rely on Gmail to make sure that they get their mail. I mean, there are numerous cases of people whose accounts have been cut off for unknown reasons by people who are using these publicly available free accounts, and customer service becomes a nightmare to try to recover them.
Oh, you can't talk to them, of course.
Right. So for those people for whom email is a mission-critical activity, and certainly the corporate world that's the case, that's very important. And, you know, for example, in our case, we use an Exchange server, which is a Microsoft product. So although I have an Outlook email client, I can also get to my email from a web browser or from another computer running Outlook or even from my iPhone, all of which get me access to wherever my mail is on the cloud. So if I don't happen to be in front of my computer here, which is a rare occasion, I'm usually stuck in front of my computer, I can get to it in any case. But I think the application of how you use your email is certainly not really relevant. So the idea that if you use Outlook, you're crazy. Most people who use email are a little nuts, so bear with me on that context. But the fact is Outlook is quite the very, very useful program for an awful lot of things where free email is sometimes you get what you pay for. And some of them are quite good. I mean, Gmail is quite an excellent piece of engineering. But it does have the problem of there's nobody to call if they accidentally shut you off.
Right.
So, whereas, you know, in certainly in the corporate world, if you have an Exchange server and it doesn't work, there's somebody to call and you can potentially hurt them.
What concerns me about Outlook or anything that's in your computer, and let's talk about that, is that, of course, once the emails are downloaded into your computer, I think, and that's only my uneducated understanding, that you are more vulnerable if the emails are inside your computer. When they come looking for addresses, they're inside your computer. But I'm sure you'll disabuse me of that notion now.
Yeah, I got it.
Okay.
The fact is you are equally vulnerable whether you get email messages in your web browser or if you get email messages in an application. And let's be clear about that. When you're using Gmail or Hotmail or any of those email services that you access through your web browser, what you're doing is you're getting your email messages through an application called a web browser, Internet Explorer or Firefox or something like that. And so that program is running on your computer, and it's giving you a view into email messages stored somewhere on a server located in the cloud. When I say the cloud, somewhere in a data center in the middle of the country someplace. When you look at your email messages through, say, Outlook, you're also looking at your email messages through an application running on your computer. And those email messages may also be stored somewhere in a data center in the middle of the country, or they may be stored locally on your computer. But the issue isn't the message itself. The issue isn't that, you know, where it's stored. The issue is how that message is viewed on your computer. And there's two aspects to this. The first and the most important is this concept of do not open attachments and do not install software onto your computer. This is the case with this piece of malware that's going out now that I talked about at the beginning of the program. Very often people will send these cute little attachments to pictures or programs or little dancing clowns or whatever it is in an email message that they want to share with other people. These are called attachments because they are pieces of software that are attached to the email message, kind of like when somebody sticks a dollar bill in the envelope with a letter. The thing is that people open those attachments, and that is the single biggest place where you can have your computer damaged, is if you open one of those attachments and something runs and installs itself onto your computer. And whether you use Gmail or whether you use Outlook or whether you use AOL or anything like that, once you run one of those attachments, you are vulnerable. So do not ever, 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 ever open an attachment. And that means that if grandma sends you a picture or somebody else sends you a picture of the kids or whatever else, you are at some risk opening those messages.
Wait a minute. Somebody's sending you pictures and photos for a book project, in my case as a publisher.
Yes.
Or something they wrote and they want you to read it.
Yes.
What do you do?
Well, for example, for pictures, I recommend you use an online service like Flickr, where you upload the pictures to a trusted online service and you give access to those pictures or to your account with those pictures to people you want to share those images with. For example, when I got married, we uploaded the wedding pictures to one of the online services and made them available to our friends so that they could, you know, gawk at the beauty of my wife and how silly I looked.
But I'm talking about things you really need in your work. Somebody's
right.
Sending it to you because you need to download it so that you can then upload it for a project or to a website. For example, I asked you for your picture. You gave me a link. I downloaded it. Well, you didn't send it to me. Granted, you gave me a link.
Yep.
But in many cases, people will attach an image of themselves or something else that I need.
Anytime you open one of those images up, you are putting yourself and your computer at risk. So there are ways around this. I mean, one of the biggest and fastest growing programs out there is something called SharePoint from Microsoft, which is basically a group sharing technology where instead of being emailed a message with like, say, a Word file, that Word file is uploaded to a central server that you can then download. Both Outlook and I think Gmail and Google offer free document sharing resources where your friends or your authors can upload their Word files to those facilities and then you can download them. See, the thing is you don't know what's going to be attached as a payload to your email message, but you have much more control. If you've only given out the password to that upload facility to two or three people, and they upload a file that they specifically worked on, you are much safer than if a message might look like it comes from somebody you know and, in fact, might have a payload attached to it, because they do.
In other words, once it's been uploaded to this group sharing site, it's scanned for viruses and then you could download it?
Depends on the service. You hope that your virus scanning program is up to date as well. And so, you know, for example, if a Word file has a virus in it, you're hoping that the service you've uploaded keeps track of that. But what you're not doing is you don't have the problem. Let's just take a picture, for example. Let's just take a JPEG that, let's say your friend sends you of her baby, okay? She decides to take a picture of her baby and send it to you, but you don't necessarily know that she sent you that. You're just getting an email from somebody with your friend's name on it that says, here's a picture of my baby. And when you open that message, what looks like a JPEG, what looks like a picture, may in fact be a program that executes that installs a little robot sitting on the back of your computer that opens up a back door that allows people to get into your computer. Because they can, you know, as you sent in a message or if your email is published online or any other way, they can find out what your email message is, what your email address is, and send you something and basically do what's called spoofing, which is basically make something that looks like something else happen and send that stuff into your computer. You know, this stuff sounds very paranoid and it sounds very science fiction and it is bizarrely real. So these cautions are really important.
So if you see this email, you open the email, are you saying by virtue of opening the email or only by virtue of clicking the image somehow? Because often the image is embedded in the email.
Yeah. Now, there's a couple things that relate to that. Certainly opening an attachment is your single largest risk. So if you're opening a file that accompanies the email message, you know, one of those little paperclip icon things?
Right.
That is the biggest risk. Yeah, the risk moves down a little further. In many cases, however, and more modern email clients are blocking this a little better, but in many cases, even looking at certain email messages can put you at some risk, especially if you haven't updated your programs. This is where one of the next precautions becomes so incredibly important. Make sure you update your operating system. Make sure you update your programs. Make sure you update your virus definitions. Because as exploits are basically things that people figure out how to do that break whatever's in the system. You know, it's like going around a house and you find a little crack in the gate and you sneak your way through the gate. That's an exploit in the computer networking world. As exploits are created and found, the folks with Microsoft and Google and AOL are working very hard to basically patch those things up so you can't get back in. But if you haven't updated your systems recently, that exploit might still be in the version of software you're running. So, you know, when Windows Update comes up and says you have an important update for Windows or important update for Internet Explorer or for Firefox or for your Mac system or for any of the other programs you run, run those updates as soon as you can. The same thing is true with antivirus stuff. Viruses, there are something called zero-day viruses, which is like the attack I mentioned at the beginning of the program. A zero-day virus is something that just happened. They just sent it out, and between the time you decide to update your viruses, for example, if you update your viruses once a week, that means there's 4 or 5 days that virus can transfer before you have defense on your systems. So it's really important to do these updates, and the quicker you do the updates and make sure that those protections are installed, the better chance you have of reading an email message not being a threat. But if you don't do those updates, and you know you haven't updated your system for 6 months, it's kind of like bending over. You're in potential trouble.
But one problem that is quite common, as I understand it, with Windows is that they're sending you updates every other day, and if you have automatic updates in a Windows computer, they will close all your programs, everything that you are working on, without notice, and update your computer. That gets really tiring, so a lot of people just turn it off and don't use it at all.
Right, and those people may lose their life savings. But it's not really as bad as it sounds. You can set up Windows Update to tell you that it's downloaded an update and ask you if it can install the new update.
Mm-hmm.
It's very easy to do from the Update Manager. There's a little option that says, automatically download the updates or automatically download the updates and restart the computer and things like that. I, for example, have it set so it automatically downloads the updates, but it notifies me in a little icon on the corner of my screen and says, there are updates to install. Can I install them? But the thing is, you got to say yes. Whenever it says, whenever it asks me, I say yes.
And it closes your computer, so everything you're working on is suddenly
right.
closed.
Yep, you shut it down, and you lose 5 minutes while, you know, your email shut down, and your word
right.
processing. But you don't have to do it the second it shows up.
Right.
But you need to do it regularly, because it's much more important. I mean, this is where sometimes I sit back and say it would be great if we didn't have to use these computers.
Mm-hmm.
Because they're really inconvenient sometimes. But the fact is being inconvenienced for the 5 minutes it takes to shut a few programs down and restart your computer is vastly more than the 300 hours you're going to need to spend if you want to try to recover, you know, various damages to your identity if you're hit with identity theft. That's a very big trade-off.
It's so interesting because, for example, we understand or we hear that Macs are less subject to such attacks, that they're stronger somehow. I don't know if that's true. Is it true?
Macs are a little less at risk. They're not a lot less at risk, but they're a little bit less at risk, in part because there's a lot less software running and there's a lot less people using Macs, and so therefore it's a much smaller target for attack. But there have been Macintosh antivirus programs in existence since way before OS X came out, way, way back.
Mm-hmm.
And there have been Macintosh viruses for many years, and there are certainly attacks that, for example, can infect your browser, installs a plugin into your browser, whether it's on Mac or Windows, and if that plugin goes on your browser, it captures all the information that you've got and sends that off to Belarus. You know, again, you need to be cautious. Now, I will tell you that a lot of the people I know who work in Homeland Security carry Macs instead of PC laptops because there is a little bit better security advantage on the Mac than there is in Windows, simply because of the number of machines out there. In terms of their inherent secure nature, Macs and Windows are both computers, and so far they're both at risk. But just because there's you know, 90 times more people using PCs than use Macs, you've got more people attacking PCs than Macs.
Is this something that the average person who might be listening, typical user of a computer, maybe not very sophisticated, should they worry a lot? Should they hire somebody to advise them? What do they do?
This is a really interesting problem. This is exactly where the Homeland Security Begins at Home becomes an issue, because we're dealing with incredibly complex machines and incredibly complex social systems. In other words, you are 14 milliseconds away from somebody in the Ukraine, for example. You know, so we have all of these very, very complex systems, and they're changing every day, and they're very hard to understand. And it certainly doesn't hurt to get advice from other people, but it also, you know, is it possible to keep up with everything? You know, I mean, it's my job to keep up with everything, and it's hard for me to do. And I have people who work for me who provide and feed me with all sorts of support information, and still it's hard to do, which is why you kind of got to go back to a few sort of motherhoods or rules of thumb, and we've talked about a few of those. You know, the rules of thumb of always update your operating system, always update your antivirus, don't open attachments, you know, things like that, because that will eliminate the bulk of the threats. Make sure you're using a firewall. You know, many of those things can eliminate a lot of the kinds of threats that exist out there. But just because you don't know that much about how the network works doesn't mean that the people on the other end don't know how your computer works.
Mm-hmm.
And you are definitely at risk. You know, the example that I gave early on of the various campaigns and their impact, you know, it was one such example. You know, in 2006, a hacker took control of a University of Washington Medical Center and got into their internal network and downloaded admissions records for 4,000 heart patients.
Ooh.
You know, I mean, that kind of stuff can be a problem. So, you know, if you look at each of these kinds of exploits, you know, you don't necessarily know that what you're doing is a problem, but if you are not protecting your machine, and something gets into you, and then you send it to somebody else who's in a more strategically important position that could cause even bigger problems, this stuff cascades all over the place. So we are all, and this brings us back to cyber war, by the way, because we are all responsible for making sure that, you know, we don't let in the Trojan horse. I mean, if you think about the story of Troy and the Trojan horse, you have this great big walled city, right? You know, and the people are outside and they're attacking the city, but there's a wall there and, you know, they can't get over the wall. But as soon as you let in the bad guys, even if you have a wall, it doesn't matter because they're now inside your wall. The same thing applies to this stuff. You know, once somebody can get into your computer, they can potentially get from your computer to your mother's computer, and from your mother's computer to, you know, her boss's computer, and from her boss's computer to, you know, let's just say the McCain campaign's computers or something like that. And this is where this threat becomes dangerous. And this is where this becomes potentially a cancer as opposed to just an inconvenience.
Well, everybody that we email, and we all make new friends all of the time in one way or another, or new colleagues, then each new email we send puts our email in their computer or their online interface, and now we're more vulnerable?
Yes.
Oh, dear.
Yes.
Okay. Well.
You know, when I got started in this computer stuff back in the 70s, it was just fun. You know, I mean, it did neat things. I mean, you could occasionally draw pictures and play space games on it. I mean, this, you know, once the internet came into play and everybody became part of this ginormous global city and everybody lives one millisecond away from everybody else, it becomes a very different game. You know, and we all have different agendas. You know, the folks who are doing identity theft, most of them want to do it because they want to make some money, you know, and they're, I got a briefing from some people who have three-letter initials who talked about these enormous databases of personal information on Americans that are just available on the internet for download. You know, you can pay $100 and download 10,000 identities for Americans. It's astonishing. You know, and that includes credit card information and checking accounts and dates of birth and the kinds of cars they drive and, you know, all this sort of stuff that creates a portfolio on us. And that's because money is to be made from this stuff. And, you know, we want to protect ourselves for the same reason. We want to make sure that, you know, our information doesn't get into other people's hands so that we don't lose, you know, what we still have left after this particularly interesting economic crash.
When I planned this show and when we talked, I had the feeling, and I don't think it's too far-fetched, that you're anticipating a major cyber attack, and we've heard that one is on the way, whether it's in a year or 2 years or three. What is it going to look like if that is the case?
Well, okay, there's a couple parts to that question. First off, I would say that I'm not anticipating a major cyber attack. To be honest, I'm anticipating many major cyber attacks.
Oh.
And I want to clarify that because the thing is that doing these attacks are very, very easy, very cost effective, and enormously, powerful. Let me give you an example of a cyber attack that took place in 2005. This one is astonishing because basically three people in the Netherlands, aged 19, 22, and 27, created what's called a botnet, a network of computers talking to each other who aim messages intended to deny service against U.S. interests. Basically, these are these little Trojan horses that run on people's computers going through like this rootkit that we talked about earlier.
Mm-hmm.
They created a network of 1.5 million compromised computers all working in tandem to attack U.S. systems and consumers. Now, to give you some perspective on this, the most powerful monolithic supercomputer that ever was recorded was the IBM Roadrunner, which in June of 2008 sustained about 1.26 petaflops, which is 10 to the 15th power floating point operations. Now, I know that's getting really technical for your listeners, but think about this. Folding at Home, which is a system that has 300,000 active PCs out there designed to help people figure out protein folding to solve some diseases, is the largest known network. But this network that these three guys created was 1.5 million computers, or about five times the single largest network known to man. And they created it on their own, basically to attack American interests. And this was in 2005. The Netherlands found them and shut them down, but, you know, some of that, those attacks are still in existence. I'll give you another example. In May of 2008, the General Accounting Office of the United States government issued a report that basically said that the Tennessee Valley Authority had terrible cybersecurity. Now, I don't know how many of your listeners know what the Tennessee Valley Authority is, but they operate 11 coal-fired fossil plants, 8 combustion turbine plants, 3 nuclear plants, and a hydroelectric system that includes 29 hydroelectric dams, all in a storage facility in the southeast. They are the nation's largest provider of the public power. And the House Subcommittee on, and this goes on for a bit, but the House Subcommittee on Emerging Threats, Cybersecurity, and Science and Technology basically said that their security was terrible, and as a result, that they were subject to all sorts of cyber attacks. Now, think about it. You're talking about nuclear plants, coal plants, combustion turbines, and hydroelectric dams all across the southeast. You know, you've got a potentially massive nightmare if these things are open to attack. I'll give you another example. The Airbus Concurrent Engineering System, which is part of the Airbus airplane, uses an internet-enabled software and maintenance service for their aircraft programs, for aircraft maintenance. So as a result, the potential to get into the aircraft through the internet and, you know, screw with maintenance systems is astonishing. And we talked about the case of the hospital as well. So these things are real, and the potential damage is enormous, and there's a lot I can't talk to you about for obvious reasons. But the thing that becomes astonishing about this is that if you combine this idea of something can run on my computer or my mom's computer or, you know, your boss's computer that sends a message that tries to deny service to another computer with something called a distributed denial of service attack. And you can take the 1.5 billion of these computers and, let's say, aim it at the system that manages, let's, for argument's sake, say, a dam. You know, you have the potential for a true disaster using this stuff. And that's where our own security at home becomes so important, because if we make sure that our own computers are as safe and secure as possible, then our computers don't become one of the little robots in the army that, you know, an enemy might attempt to use to attack other people. So it's not only protecting our own interests, in other words, my credit card account or your credit card account, it's also protecting national interests. And we can all participate in that by making sure we know a little bit more about how our computers work, learn what a firewall is, make sure we, you know, put up with the 5 minutes once a day to restart our computer, even though it's inconvenient, things like that.
I wish everybody that I know had just heard what you had to say. That was a very important thought that you put forward, and I think that most people do not connect their own computer and their as a an area of responsibility related to the nation. It's like,
yeah,
this is my computer, and then there's the nation, and the government should take care of everything else, right?
Well, I mean, here's a good example of this. Let's assume that you have a fire department that's designed, that listens, gets calls from the phone and responds. So, you know, somebody calls up and says, hi, there's a fire on 4th Street. But now everybody in your town, it dials the fire department at once with some garbage, you know, telling them the time of day or who won the baseball game or something like that. Now no one can call in to that fire department to tell them there's a fire to put out.
Right.
That's a denial of service attack. Now, instead of everybody in your town with a telephone, everybody in your town with a computer. Except that it's not just in your town, it's all across the world. These things talk to each other and can be targeted at a particular location.
And your computer is being used as part of this. Without your knowledge, would you know that your computer is being used?
In most cases, no. Although if you start to see strange slowdowns or strange reboots or, you know, things like that, you can begin to get an idea that maybe it's time to run a virus check on your computer or run a spyware check on your computer, things like that.
Another question related back to the email. When people send email where the pictures are inside the email, not as attachments, especially if they're using a Mac, they often come inside the email. But you open the email because you know it's from your friend. Is that dangerous as well?
You know, that's one that's kind of interesting, because what happens is that actually is using an exploit in how email is not meant to send stuff,
mm-hmm.
but because users like to see pictures in line, it's basically in as part of the message,
mm-hmm.
this exploit has been used. But the thing that's interesting is that spammers use this all the time. It's why, you know, sometimes on your Gmail account, it'll say, would you like to see images? And you say yes or no.
Right.
But some messages you don't, and as a result, you see, you know, all this Viagra stuff or all these pictures of pills or whatever it happens to be. It's because of this little exploit that's used, you know, both by the bad guys and by people who, like, for example, make Mac software or, you know, some of the Outlook stuff embeds it in and some of the other programs do. The risk is twofold. It's not as huge a risk as if you open an attachment because it's just showing an image. It's not running a program. Unless, of course, you haven't updated your computer, in which case you could be running a program. So this is, again, you must update your computer because for a while, a year or so ago, for example, they managed to embed inside a JPEG message a piece of code that would execute based on a flaw in the way the JPEG format was created. Now, that got fixed very, very quickly. But those people who didn't run the updates didn't get that fix, and so, you know, the problem went on. But, you know, the other thing about it, though, is that image basically sends a note back to the sender telling them that you opened up an email message or that you looked at an email message. Now, in most cases, it's not a particularly big risk, but it does leave an extra footprint to the sender saying that you're real and that you did open a message, and it tells them what your IP address is, basically the equivalent of your computer's phone number, potentially your email address and things like that. So
wait a minute. I'm trying to understand you. This is very important. Just because I view an image, or anybody else does, that sends a message back to the person who sent it to me? Do they know they have a message?
No. And they don't send it necessarily to the person who sent it to you. That sends a message back to the server from which the image originated.
Oh. Okay.
So, you know, sometimes, for example, you get stationery, you get this email stationery, and you send a pretty picture with let's just say, you know, teddy bears or something on it.
Right.
That email, that particular picture doesn't necessarily come from your friend's computer. It
right.
may come from a third-party service, like one of those e-card services or something like that.
Right.
That image has to come to your computer from somewhere. It comes to your computer from a central computer called a server. As soon as that image is pulled off of that server and brought to your computer, it leaves a footprint that says, what is the IP address, which is basically the Internet Protocol address or the equivalent of a computer's phone number, and when was it taken, and what time and what location did this come from? From your IP address, for example, you can tell what town you're from. You know, all sorts of information like that can be left in that footprint. This is also what we use as forensic people to find where people came from. So, in other words, it works both ways. You know, one of the ways that law enforcement can find the bad guys is that, you know, some of these footprints are left around that we can trace and locate and then go off and potentially capture and, you know, punish the people who have done bad things. So it does work both ways.
So the inline image might be sending a message about your computer, not downloading into it, but
right.
sending a message about it. But people sometimes will send 5 or 6 images in line, especially, by the way, from AOL.
Yeah, I try to advise everybody to not use AOL. That's, to a certain extent, that's a personal prejudice, but it also, you know, if you think about it, AOL is often the first entry point for non-expert computer users, which means they are also the biggest target for people who want to exploit them, which means that AOL is often more... that has more attacks going against it than some of the other things like Gmail, simply because the people who use it are less expert in using it and therefore become low-hanging fruit.
What kind of economic crisis are we talking about when these things start to happen? And you said that you expect many major attacks, so what are we talking about in terms of the nation?
Well, you know, again, it depends on when and how that happens. But, you know, just take a look at it, for example, when I'll give you an example of a very simple piece of minor identity theft. When my wife and I drove from New Jersey down to Florida, we used credit cards to buy gas along the way. And somewhere at one of the gas stations, somebody swiped our credit card information, and all of a sudden we started getting charges on our card from somewhere out in the Phoenix area. You know, that took, you know, first off, the charges showed up on our cards, and it took a couple of weeks for my wife to chase down with the credit card companies and take care of that. What was the economic damage? Well, eventually the credit card company ate the charge, so it didn't cost us, but it cost them. But it did cost us a lot of time. It cost her hours of time and hours of phone call and a little bit of stress and some concern and so forth. Now, if you multiply that across everybody, you're talking about billions of dollars in both time and actual money. And, of course, if something is charged and, let's just say, Visa or MasterCard eats that, but the money winds up in let's, for argument's sake, say, Belarus or the Ukraine, well, then that money has left the American economy and has wound up in the Ukrainian economy. And that stuff happens relatively measurably. I mean, the FTC talks about huge percentages of identity theft complaints that they get every year. And many of those are ones where the money in somebody's account winds up going to a foreign nation. And usually somebody, a foreign nation that we don't particularly like as a nation ourselves. This is an economic thing. I mean, one of the things that that I talk about in my lectures on cyber war is that, cyber war is one of the only kinds of warfare that we've had in human history that can be a profit center. In other words, it is so inexpensive to conduct that it is very possible, to make a lot of money by doing it. You know, and there's an ROI from it. I mean, identity theft is something that can generate money coming in addition to causing damage going out. To put this into sort of daunting perspective, according to CNN, the U.S. spent a minimum of about $5.8 trillion on nuclear weapons programs from 1940 to about 1996. That's $5.8 trillion. You know, now, while a cyber attack is unlikely to cause a loss of life on the level of a hydrogen bomb, you can spend about $314 to buy a computer that can have a similar level of damage to businesses and to the economy with a cyber attack. You know, so you're talking about a cost-effective ratio of $300 to $5.8 trillion. You know, multiply that thing out and it gets scary.
It is scary. I'm so glad you're on this show because I think people need to know this and how, you know, we might read something about identity theft or follow across an article from, you know, while waiting in the airport, but you're putting it in such keen perspective.
Yeah, let me talk about something that can actually help your listeners.
All right.
on a tangible level. There's something called a firewall. Those are the little things that you get from your cable modem people or the DSL people that sit between you and the outside world. They're called firewalls or they're called routers. And they're often these little blue boxes or whatever. What they do is they take they work like a PBX. They take the outside IP address, the IP address that the cable company gives to your home, and converts it to an internal IP address, kind of like an extension on a phone. So that what happens is messages that come into your network have to go through this little box and then traverse to the computers at home. And what that means is that you have this barrier between the outside world and your computers at home, which is called this router or firewall. If you're not using a router or firewall, you should call your cable company or call your DSL provider and ask them if either they can provide you with one or recommend you get one and help you install them. And even if you have to go buy these things, they're like $40. They're relatively inexpensive, but they're so important because they provide a very, very tangible first-level blockade between the outside world and your computer. Without a firewall, you know, somebody in another country can literally directly connect from their computer to your computer with nothing in the way. But if you put this little teeny box in the way, you're protecting yourself a great deal. So the first thing to go learn about is learn about firewalls. The next thing, as I mentioned, is don't open attachments. And the third thing I mentioned is make sure you update your antivirus, your Windows and Mac software, and your anti-spyware stuff and your browsers. Make sure you do all those updates. That set of instructions can really substantially increase your protection against this sort of damage. It's sort of the practicing safe sex equivalent for the cyber world.
When I talk about an IP address, I've also been offered from the telephone company an opportunity to continuously change the IP address. They charge more for it, and they do it in some areas and not other areas. It's very confusing. How does that differ from what you've just described?
Okay. First off, let's understand that an IP address is the internet address of your computer.
Right.
Every individual computer on the internet at a given time has one address. It's a series of four numbers separated by dots. So what happens is this is like a phone number. Literally, you connect to that IP address to connect to your computer. Now, some people want a fixed IP address, one that never changes. That's so that they can run a website or something like that, and people can get to their computer remotely. Other people want to see that IP address change all the time, because then it's a little harder to know I'm going to this computer or that computer.
Right.
Now, the thing is about changing the IP address all the time is that programs talking to your computer, legitimate programs talking to your computer, will occasionally get confused doing that. It's actually far better, although that's a nice little precaution. I wouldn't necessarily recommend paying extra for it. Much more important is to put a router or firewall between the outside network and your computers. So it is a vastly better thing, because one is that generally firewalls won't break software that's trying to talk to you. And two, they do a lot to make sure that that IP address that's at the outside world doesn't mean anything when talking to your computer. So I would advise, instead of doing that, I would advise making sure you get a firewall.
Can individuals help the overall country's defenses here in any way beyond keeping their computers clean and safe?
Yes, certainly, but to a certain extent. I mean, I have a strong background in computer science, so I can understand this stuff a little bit more than the average individual, but the fact is I'm pretty much an average individual who works, you know, I'm right now in my home talking to you, and I can get out there and help advise other people on this. I mean, one of the things that people can do is communicate to other people the importance of not sending attachments and installing firewalls and doing those updates. Basically, you know, we just saw the benefit of organizing amongst all these people for this presidential campaign, regardless of, you know, who you wanted to win. We saw the idea of communities working together and people knocking, going door to door and explaining to them the benefits of their particular campaign. You know, talk to your family and friends and coworkers about the importance of doing these updates and protecting themselves using these very simple processes, because it really is important. And, you know, you can protect yourself, but if you talk to 10 friends, you've now, you know, helped 10 people go through the little process of protecting themselves. Well, make the most of this program. You know, one of the things that you can do is make this program available for people to listen to, you know, on a regular basis. You know, make a capture.
We're going to have this one live, and it'll be on your site. When they came to RightsRadio.com and they searched for your name, you have your own little page there already, and we're going to put a copy of this up on that page. And
so
they may be listening to you from that page right now.
So one of the things that your reader, your listeners can do is send people to that page and have them listen to this broadcast and help them understand what's going on as well. So people can take some action on their own. And the other thing is to understand that this stuff is complex, but the service providers who are working on this are working really hard to solve it. You know, I've heard from time to time people saying that the folks at Microsoft or the folks at Google or whatever don't care about this. They're hit by this as much or worse than we are. I mean, you know, Microsoft set out to make a nice little operating system. They didn't expect that, you know, foreign nations would attempt to attack it. You know, none of us expected this sort of stuff to happen back in the 80s when we started going online in a big way. So understand that these companies are working very hard to protect your interests. But you have to cooperate too. I mean, they've got to install some of these updates for your own protection. And you know, sometimes they're not for your own protection. Sometimes they're to add digital rights management and other stuff in there. And that's some place where I would advise people to stay away from if they can. But the fact is in most cases this is all an attempt to button down our systems so that we don't have these kinds of threats coming, you know, from people who are creative and want to take advantage of, let's just say, our freedoms and good life.
David, we have just a minute to go, so I'm going to have to start saying goodbye soon. But before I do, I would like to give out any information about your website, how people can contact you, your service. It's your minute.
Okay. Well, I'm going to give you one website to start with. It's www.emailsgone, E-M-A-I-L-S, gone. com. That's actually the website for my book, but there's a button on there that says where to get help, and there's about 15 free articles on how to protect yourself against identity theft and all of these issues. Just click the where to get help button. It will also take you to our other magazines, OutlookPower.com, which is for those people who use Outlook, Computing Unplugged, which is for those people who are using any kinds of computers. And we provide tons of free information online all the time. So the easiest thing to do is go to that emailsgone.com website and click where to get help, and there'll be a lot of help available. They can also go to our corporate website, which is zatz.com, Z-A-T-Z.com, and that'll click them into everything that we produce at Zatz. But I would also recommend that they sign up and read outlookpower.com, which is our email website. Now, it's focused on Outlook, but we do a lot of coverage of identity theft issues. We do a lot of coverage of things like Gmail issues and AOL mail issues and anything that relates to email. And all of that is free. They can search for articles and read them, and it's a very, very useful free resource. So those are the things I would recommend. And again, I can't stress this enough. Make sure you have a router. Update your antivirus definitions. Update your operating system, and do not open attachments.
David, I can't thank you enough for being on my show today. It's really been a pleasure, and we'll do everything we can to carry the word and to draw people to this tape so that they can hear the replay of our conversation. And I hope that you'll be with us again in the future, because I know that if anyone missed you this time, they're going to want to hear you next time.
Well, I would love to, and anytime I can answer questions, feel free. You've been a fabulous host, and this has been a lot of fun.
Okay, well, this is Dr. Joyce Starr from RightsRadio.com and StarrPublications.com. Thank you for being with us today, and we'll be with you again in 2 more weeks. Bye-bye.